More than that, when the whistleblower first came forward, Trump allies said it was hearsay. When first-hand witnesses confirmed the whistleblower's complaint, up to and including people who heard Trump's phone call with the Ukraine president and complained about it. And when U.S. diplomats were told to defer to Giuliani and smeared if they didn't, Trump allies denied this rose to the level of an impeachable offense. And kept obsessing over the identity of the whistleblower. And ignored the witnesses who confirmed the whistleblower's complaint with first-hand testimony under their own names and faces. Trump and company defenders complained about due process but refused to show up to testify. They complained about closed hearings, then complained about the open ones. They said, "Where are the transcripts?" And then, like Lindsey Graham, claimed there was no point in reading them because there's nothing to see here. But there was. For the complete playlist of songs and sound bites on What's the Frequency, Kenneth, you can go to the program's Facebook page. What's the Frequency, Paul? Again this week, no time for the short music credits either. Need to spend the rest of the program asking you to help this frequency. WBAI-FM in New York City at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org with a donation to keep the lights on and the programs coming. Can you The best way to do it? Become a BAI buddy. It's easy, and if enough people do it, maybe the station can have fewer on-air fundraisers and fewer program preemptions. To become a BAI buddy, go to give to WBAI.org. That's give, the number 2, WBAI.org, and pledge $10 a month for the next 12 months. More if you can afford it. But $10 a month for a year, and it goes a long way to give the station a reliable and predictable base of listener support for a whole year. It has the added benefit of a more direct link between what the station does every day and what you do as a listener every day. It's not about buying premiums. It's about supporting the radio station for what you get from the programs you listen to. So become a BAI buddy. Go to give to WBAI.org. That's give, the number 2, WBAI.org. With a monthly donation of $10 for the next 12 months. Look, a lot's changed around here since I started at WBAI during the Paleolithic era and went away for 3 decades to work at CBS News. But the basic concept still holds: non-commercial, listener-sponsored radio. It doesn't matter if you're listening to the radio, listening online, listening to programs on demand, on your smartphone. Instead of corporate underwriters and a few rich people, WBAI asks for donations from the people who listen. Even my cat knows that's the right thing to do. So cool in this You can respond by going to givetowbai.org. That's give, the number two, wbai.org, and make a donation. Better yet, becoming a BAI buddy with a monthly donation of $10 for the next 12 months. So go ahead and do it. Go to givetowbai.org and become a listener sponsor. Become a BAI buddy. And speaking of BAI buddies, my longtime BAI colleague and adjacent time slot mate, Jim Freund, is back with Hour of the Wolf. Just another reason to go give to WBAI.org. That's give, the number two, WBAI.org. And pledge $10 a month for the next 12 months. Thanks.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, webcasting over WBAI.org, and also visible on Facebook Live in the WBAI Radio Forum, the Hour of the Wolf Forum. Or if you prefer the, my timeline, Jim Freund. Okay? Is that enough? Yeah, that's enough. Let's start the show. Good morning. For the first time since late September, this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. This morning, we will hear a rebroadcast of a reading from the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings done by N.K. Jemisin. Gotcha. Stay tuned. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My, what a long, strange trip it has been. Last time I spoke to you in capacity as Hour of the Wolf was the last week in September. And we were to begin, we began our fundraising drive first week in October. And I was preempted that week. Very often during the fundraising drives, they alternate me 1 week off, 1 week on. Okay, usually I'm on the first week. Hey, it doesn't matter. It was fine. Except that I had this delusion that the second week in October, this radio station would still exist with the people who built it, comprise of it, program it, and all that good stuff would still be in control of it, broadcasting. Well, you've probably all followed the news. I'm not going to recap this entire affair. I think that is going to be done. I believe reporter Rebecca Miles is going to be doing something on it. And Rebecca, if you hear me, if you hear from me, from somebody else, if I can lend a hand, please, I would love to. So, October 7th, we go off the air. October 8th, we organize. But not before the people who took us off the air, who were, you will hear this term often, a rogue minority. We jumped to the conclusion, we who were not aware of what was going on, that it was Pacifica that took us off the air, like they did in 1977. But no, it was a group of people from Pacifica maintaining that they represented Pacifica, which they did not. They had voted on this whole thing, having scapegoated WBAI for the financial woes of the five member stations, plus the Pacifica archives, plus the national finances, and laid it all on BAI, and are continuing to say, hey, you put BAI back on the air, that's the end of Pacifica. Well, that may be true, because basically, it is my opinion that they wanted to basically cannibalize us for parts. Dave Kenny, good to hear you and see you. Well, good to hear you this coming Saturday on Everything Old is New Again. What time, Dave? Is it 9 o'clock? 8 o'clock? Whenever, just listen all Saturday. Listen to Everything Old is New Again. Listen to, it is Saturdays, right? At any rate, Dave is a newbie to the radio station. He came here, Dave Kenny is who I'm talking to on Facebook. He came to BAI in the mid-70s, whereas I started in 1967. Ah! Of course, I was 13 years old, but I get to say I've been here for the better part of a century. Thank you, Simon Lokley, for being the person who pointed out that I can say things like that. Okay, so what they did, these people representing themselves as Pacifica, they never brought it to the board for a vote. When it was brought to the board, they were voted down. The interim executive director, how is this, the wolf? I got a haircut. The executive director, interim executive director, and seven cronies brought it to a vote, were voted down. And the Pacifica National Board mandated that things return to the way they were before October 7th. This wasn't enough for these people. A temporary restraining order wasn't enough, and they kept trying to bump it to a higher court. They brought it to federal court, who said, no, this is state level, brought it back down. They said, well, we're based in California, and was, no, sorry, this is a New York State business. You are going to be tried and lost in New York State. A court order brought us back on the air last Wednesday at about 5 p.m., when program director Linda Perry knew that we were going back on, she left me a voicemail message saying, hi, Jim, we're going back on the air at midnight. I want you there at 12. Now, I've had a problem with my otherwise wonderful phone, the one which, if you're on Facebook Live, hey, Heller. Yes, my when you're doing a selfie, your camera is reversed. So I'm in the mirror universe. So Frank Heller being one of the great programmers of WBAI, and I really do want you on the air, Frank. I'm serious when I say that. It's not joshing. We need to do a show together. Anyway. See, that's what happens. I say I pay attention to Facebook Live, and I lose my train of thought. It doesn't take much to distract me. So, I finally get the voicemail message. I actually don't hear the message. I never actually got the voicemail message, but I use this wonderful spiffy thing called Google Voice. And what it does is when somebody leaves you a voicemail, it transcribes it and sends it to you as an email. I saw that at about 10 p.m. I think I didn't hear my phone ring because Linda called somewhere between 5 and 6:30 p.m. and I was taking a nap, which at my extreme advanced age, well, not quite, but at my age, I get tired when I wake up in mornings. I used to wake up at 11 or 1 o'clock or something. Now I'm waking up at relatively normal times. I take naps. I took a nap, and at 10 p.m., I get this message saying, be there at midnight. Well, I came in. The people who were largely responsible for having won the cases in court and bringing what was going on, our side of the story, to public attention, were all here. And I got to do the first station break when we went back to under local control. And they were wondering, why does he want to do the station break? And it's like, you know what? If you go through the annals of WBAI history, there are people like Max Schmid and myself, for that matter, we can say that we know that when we moved from 39th Street to 62nd Street, it was Larry Josephson who did the first break, and so on and so forth. It's minor. It's, for me, a little piece of history, a little piece of ego boo, as they say in science fiction fandom, I should say, as we say in science fiction fandom. I got to do that, and then as of 1 o'clock, I kept everybody in the room so they could all sing along to a proper union song, as done by Natalie Merchant. Which Side Are You On is a great song when anybody in the world, even I, try to sing it. But Natalie Merchant does an exceedingly, amazingly powerful version. And then Fran Luck, a.k.a. Pirate Jenny, and Ken Gale, a.k.a. The Other Ken, stayed on, and we stayed on the air, as requested by Linda, till 5 a.m. I do not consider last week's show an Hour of the Wolf. I consider it a welcome back to the real WBAI. This week, it's welcome back to Hour of the Wolf. We will resume our quasi-format next week, which is opening theme music. Then, if Dan Persons has a movie review, we will hear that. And then, now I had this discussion with Linda in September that she noticed that the ratings, yes, we occasionally get ratings, were that my first hour is weaker than my second, which is weird. I wonder if that means West Coast people are tuning in. But she said, what do you do? And I said, well, usually, I have a guest, they come in, they talk. After about 45 minutes to an hour, they read a story. That starts the second hour. She said, from now on, try starting with that hot material first. And I will. After this week. This week, it's welcome back. Welcome to you, the listenership. Welcome to us. A lot of people don't realize we are back on. We got so much publicity about being off. We are not getting that much publicity from the mainstream press saying that we're back on. I've got to thank the reporter at the Brooklyn Eagle, one of the most venerable papers, along with the New York Times, in all of New York City, and did some wonderful coverage and posted all these photos of me. They had a lot of photos of me because about half a year ago, Mimi Mondville, who's been a regular guest on this program, she's out of town now, I hope she'll be back, wrote an article, a feature about me, and a photographer came here and to my home and took photos. But it's the pictures that they took when they did that feature on me that they were using for BAI coverage. And out of about seven or eight articles, if you go to the Brooklyn Eagle and search for my name, search for Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, you'll see, a lot of those articles. Actually, better search on WBAI, and you'll see all these photographs of me. Now, and that's one of the reasons that even though I'm on my own this week, I'm doing the video Facebook Live, because one photo that they used twice was taken from right behind me. Those people watching on Facebook can see where I'm pointing. And it went right to my bald spot. You see, and it's like, oh, my God, really? Okay. Nonetheless, they did some excellent articles. So what I want to do this morning, we have some great material for you. And I want to make sure we had great material so that you know just how bleeping important not only this radio station, but Hour of the Wolf is. So we'll be hearing a reading. It runs a little under an hour by Norma Jemison. And I want to put that on, by 1:30. Okay, it's 1:21 in New York City now. But this is key. At the time we were taken off the air with the bogus excuse that we were costing money, we were in one of our most successful fund drives in a long time, which means that we lost not only the listenership, but the money and the momentum we were getting. Now, here's the idea behind listener-sponsored radio, folk. If you build it, they will come. And we've had a lot of decent programming. It has been getting so much better in the last year, year and a half. And so we're getting a higher listenership, and we're getting a bigger response when we beg on the air. I, for one, do not believe that it's all about what premiums are you offering. The incentive is if you have good programming, people will pay for it. That is the premise behind listener-sponsored radio, as created by Lou Hill in 1946 in a monograph that he wrote called, amazingly, Pacifica. That's what we're based on. Now, one of the things that we are really, really focusing on is this, not gimmick, but this idea of something that we have that is called a BAI buddy. And that what that means is that you give a recurring donation every month, which I think one of the main reasons, this is supposition, but I think one of the main reasons that management wants us to push the BAI buddy, especially now, is if you promise that you're going to give, oh, $10 a month or $25 a month or whatever, they can budget that in. They can say, we know that we're going to get, you know, this person's giving $10 a month, therefore we can project that's $120 that we're going to receive over the next year. There's another reason why they like that BAI buddy thing. When they took away our toys, they took away our bank accounts, our email accounts and all that. They took away our money, not mentioning a lot of the money that had come in. There was a huge bequest that went to Pacifica that we never got the credit or the money for. All this stuff went on. But I believe, please notice every time I say believe, it's a very important term. I believe that we actually had control of the BAI buddy money, which is a very good thing. So, rather than say, if you call up now, we're going to give you this tote bag, this pin, or something. Oh, no, excuse me. If you become a BAI buddy, you get a BAI buddy tote bag. Well, how about that? Let me read you what it says on the newly returned website. A BAI buddy is someone who signs up to make a recurring monthly donation to WBAI. That's bold. That's my bold voice. Either using a credit or a debit card. It's safe, secure, simple, automatic, and means a great deal to keeping our unique and high-quality programming on the air. Also keeps on the air the program that isn't as high quality. But once you've joined, you will receive a BAI buddy card and WBAI tote bag. The card allows you to participate in the many, many, many member benefits, including discounts offered by our BAI buddy partners. See info at right. I'm looking on the right. I think we need to get some more buddy partners. Okay, to become a BAI buddy, fill out and submit the secure form below. By the way, you get this form by going to wbai.org/BAI buddy, or just go to wbai.org and it'll tell you how to donate. Once your annual donation reaches or exceeds $25, you'll become a voting member of WBAI. That's an important thing. It means you get to vote on who will be on the board. And since, you know, given the events of October, we know how important that board composition is. Let's see. The day of the month that you sign up will be the day of the month that the charge to your card will be made monthly. Okay, uses the word month three times in a sentence. But you may choose a date, cancel, or change your donation amount at any time by emailing for quick response or by calling a telephone number. Yeah, I'll give it to somebody's office, 212-209-2827, to leave a message. Your subscription will continue until you cancel it. Okay, so, yes, this is what I was looking for. If, for any reason, you prefer to sign up through a live person, you can phone, you can call, you can speak to a human being. Area code 516-620-3602. Once again, 516-620-3602, and tell them that you want to become a BAI buddy. We'll be glad to help you get set up. So what we're asking for is become a BAI buddy. You're generous, Stone. Amounts that we are looking for are generally increments of 10, not increments, but $10, $25, $50, $100, $500, or $1,000, or blank. You can actually fill in and determine your own amount, okay? Let me encourage people to start at 25. If you can't afford 25, give 10. But please, now you know. You know, how often do we say, imagine a world without WBAI? Well, you had it. You had it for a month. There was this so-called Pacifica National programming, which I called Pacifica Pablum. No, it wasn't all bad shows, but it was shows from California. It was not, it was community radio. It's just that it wasn't this community. We need to keep our community together. We need your help. We need your support. So please give a phone call to 516-620-3602 or aim your browser at WBAI.org or even give to WBAI.org. But WBAI.org is easier. And just follow the prompts, okay? We're going to talk about that again later, but I'd like to take a telephone call or two, see what people have to say, and then we're going to hear a reading by Nora Jemison. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hello. Are you a person or are you an empty line? You're an empty line. Hi there. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for taking calls. And I did have something to add to the buddy, all of that information.
Yeah.
According to Linda Perry's cart that she did, she said about $890 was needed to support and sustain hourly. $890 was needed for every hour of the week, and there's 168 hours in the week. That means that if you ask for a buddy for $10 per month or 120 total, I'm so glad you asked for more, but in any ways, most people are asking for just 10.
Yeah, because it's easier for people to give 10.
Yes, so based on that, you're right, absolutely right. And I like, that's a good point, a very important point. And so based on that, though, and based on the hourly thing, that means, and I love how you said that this has to be budgeted in for the year. It is starting, you know, $10 a month in January of 2020 coming up, let's say. Let's look for this next year.
This is
so guess how many,
supposition
guess how
on
many,
my part.
Guess how many buddies are needed per hour. That means, so if you have an hourly show, now you have a two-hour show, right?
Correct.
Okay, but if you just have an hour show, based on the $890 that Linda Perry put in her card is needed, you need 386 buddies by January 1st, 2020. So in like about a month and a half now, we need every hourly show to get 386 buddies. But, you see, rather than everybody going, you know, well, be a buddy to my show, we should all producers should have the big goal of getting 64,848 buddies.
Ooh,
for the
you've
whole,
done your math. Okay.
Well, I'm an accountant. So, but thank you so much. But you see, we all should pull together rather than, oh, be a buddy for my show, and then keep score like they do for fundraisers. Oh, we've gotten so many so far, 1,000 buddies. But listen, we need 64,848 buddies in the next month and a half to be signed up at $120 a year or $10 a month, so that starting in January, all those buddies give the $10,000, because altogether is needed $7,750,000 a year based on Linda's estimate of $890. $5 per hour.
Yeah, I'm not sure where that figure comes from.
It's... Well, you know what? That's the problem. See, nobody knows the severity of the need. We have to...
I mean, that may be the entire... I would guess that sounds to me not like WBAI's debt, but all of Pacifica's debt.
Well, the thing is, I'm doing it based on, remember, the estimate on the cart of $890 an hour.
Yeah, I haven't heard that card. Maybe I'll play it in a little while.
Yes, and you see, that's what it's based on. And when you figure out how many hours in a year, you see,
yeah,
52 weeks in a year, all of this, you know, you put this in 168 hours a week times 52 weeks in a year times the $890 per hour, you come up with over $7.75 million for the year.
Yeah, but
that's what the figures say. That's what it says,
okay,
based on that amount.
I'm not sure exactly what our rent, now that, thank God,
yes,
we're out of Empire, is. I know what our rent is here at on Atlantic Avenue. I have a rough idea of what the rent is for the transmitter.
Yes. And how much is it?
I'm sure I'm wrong. I'm going to say 40,000 monthly.
40,000 for the transmitter on Times Square?
No, yes.
40,000
a month.
Down from 50,000.
Down
on
from
the Empire
65,000. Yes.
Down from 65,000. You see, this is so nice to have the figures. And what is the rent on, you know, for this new 388 Atlantic Avenue?
You can say new. We've been here 5 years.
Well,
but four and a half anyway. I don't know the exact figure. I can tell you it's a lot less than we have paid in a long, long time.
Do you know about what it is?
About 10,000.
10,000. So you
Which see, is nothing.
Yes. And so you see the thing
For a
is
popular
so,
street in Brooklyn and most of an entire floor in a fashionable townhouse in an up-and-coming area with a cafe below that we can rent or use for events and stuff like that, roughly 10,000. Now, you see, I don't know. Next time I see Melissa Ennin, who's the owner of this building with whom I work for my reading series, I will ask her.
Good. And then you see...
And by the way, I should mention that when Pacifica was saying that we hadn't paid our rent, that'd be like 3 months in arrears, that A, wasn't true, and B, when it was mentioned to a listener went and paid our rent for October and November.
Mm-hmm.
We are ahead in our rent.
Oh, great. And one other thing is the pensions for the engineers and the people who are employed, you see.
All
you have
six
to take
people.
Take that in together. Right.
That's all, you know.
Right.
We have the smallest staff.
I know,
in
but
Pacifica
what,
Radio.
Okay, the people who had retired earlier, they're not getting their pension?
I don't know. I'm not aware of anybody who's actually retired.
Well, fired, they still get a pension.
Maybe so, but I don't know that we were in SAG.
Right.
We're the union here is SAG-AFTRA.
Yes.
And
it's
a great union to be a member of.
Oh,
if,
yes.
If you're lucky enough to earn your SAG card.
Yes, yes.
But having said that, we don't have more than 10 people in the history of BAI. We haven't had 20 people that are union members.
Oh, really?
We've got about 6.5 people, full-time employees, FTEs. You're a bookkeeper. 6.5 FTEs.
Oh, no, I'm not just a bookkeeper.
Oh, you're an accountant. Better. Okay, so you know what FTE means. So we have about 6.5 FTEs on our payroll. Now, of those, 3 of them are management. They are not union.
Now, FTE, so do tell the audience what FTE stands for.
I mentioned it before. Full-time employees. So if you have somebody who's working part-time, that's a half. That's why we have 6.5.
You know, all our employees. You make me laugh because all our politicians, they work part-time jobs and they get pensions anyway with taxpayer expense. But anyway, that's just an aside.
Well, it's whatever SAG-AFTRA demands.
Yes, I understand. And you know what? The thing is that the numbers don't lie because if we get the $890 an hour, we have to figure out exactly where that $7,750,000 rounded is going. And you see,
I can tell you a few things. I can tell you that in order to get out of the encumbrance of the Empire State Building rent, a loan or a mortgage or something, I think it was a loan, was taken out to like $2.something million. This was not taken out by WBAI. Taken out by Pacifica again. And the rent, the lease on the Empire State Building that was ridiculously high. Was not taken out by WBAI. It was taken out by Pacifica. Just saying that because people need to realize how much we've been scapegoated here.
Yes, and how much we owe, and therefore why.
Well, how much we as an entity, assuming that once again we can call ourselves Pacifica, which, you know, there's still a bit of a rift. You know, that we've won a battle. We have not won the war.
Well, I know.
I'm speaking to the galleries. I'm speaking to the audience.
Unfortunately, see, the war's going to be won by money.
Lost by money.
And we need to keep the goal of 64,848 buddies by January 1st, according to the cart that I remember.
I will have to listen to it, but all that I'm saying is I'm not, even in when we owned our own building on 62nd Street and we were paying Empire and all of that good stuff, our annual budget was about $3.5 million, and that's in the 70s, so adjusted to the present that would be much more, but our budget is much less than that per year.
Well, one would think so, but it's not, according to the numbers.
Well,
Berthold Reimers needs to come forward when we have the 2-hour session where he spends most of the time talking without taking questions or answering them.
I would suggest pay attention to the local board members that are members of the Finance Committee.
Well, I've listened to Mr. R. Martin.
Paul Martin, yes.
R. Paul Martin, many years ago when he said that the auditor, that when you had an audit, said that it was the worst, the worst he had ever seen. In other words, WBAI was not a growing concern.
No, we were not, and we are not. But that
you bet.
It's also it's a failure all around.
You bet. So let's get the goal of everybody working together to get the 64,848 buddies in the next month and a half. But is that realistic? Do we have even 64,848 listeners to begin with?
We do not.
We don't. So the goal, you see,
Let me throw one statistic at you. At the height of WBAI's popularity, when this was the second most listened to FM station in all of the metropolitan area, we had about 40,000 subscribers. And we were very much in the black. So, again, I really wonder where the $7 million figure comes from.
Oh, well, see.
But you know what? I'll be seeing R. Paul soon enough. He's an old, dear friend of mine.
Yeah, I know, but
we don't agree on WBAI politics, but I know that he speaks truth.
Oh, yes. I loved hearing him. But you know what? He was sort of gagged. and he couldn't tell us anymore. He used to he was a whistleblower. That's why I loved his program.
There's a lot that as an officer of Pacifica, and of WBAI, there's a lot that he's unable to say. It's not that he was gagged.
Why is that? Why can't we have transparency? That's not right.
Executive session and numbers and like that are true in every organization that is incorporated in the United States of America.
So they tell us.
And that's the law.
Own it. The people own it.
No, you don't. Sorry.
We're owned by
an educational foundation in California. Let's be clear on that.
Yes, you're right. Now, that foundation
holds the ability to broadcast on this frequency in a public trust.
Yes.
And the public owns the airwaves.
Yes.
But you do not own World Broadcast Associates Incorporated.
That's right. And see, this is why I'm coming to you tonight, to give you the figures.
But I question those figures.
Okay. With all due respect.
I will listen to the CART. I will try to play that CART. But you know what? I have to get back to doing my show.
Oh, right. Yes. And see, this is the thing. Is it unrealistic to expect 64,848 buddies?
Yes.
And that's my point, actually. You've got it.
But it's not unrealistic to ask for people to become a buddy right now.
Yeah, but
one by one. Let's deal with that number.
I understand,
okay?
but let's let everybody know how many buddies we need.
First of all, we don't even know. Our management people have been trying to publish the figures of how many buddies are raised by how many people. And you know what? We don't have a system. Everything was taken away from us. We don't know. We do not know how many buddies belong to what shows and so on and so forth.
Why do that? Why have a competition? Why not get the community work together?
Well, the answer to that is when they are trying to put together the fund drives and who is on when, the question is who will be most effective in raising money? And that's why.
That can be inside information and that can be used, of course, but we should try to get everybody united for once and
okay, but let's not give numbers that are beyond people's reckoning.
This is the point.
The number is when I ask people to become a WBAI buddy, I'm talking to one person at a time on a many leveled.
Anybody watching on Facebook,
anybody listening to a rebroadcast, anybody listening live, I'm talking to you. I'm talking to one person.
That's beautiful. And you see, that would be lovely.
Lots of one people are what make the community.
That's true.
Okay.
However, is it practical? Remember, I said
that I needed to play a tape starting at 1:30?
Yes, it's 10 to 2.
Okay. Okay.
Is it practical, though? We've got to get real. All right.
Okay.
Love you so much.
Thank you so much. The way that we get real is by the doing of it and not by saying, is it realistic? I don't care. It's realistic for you who's listening right now, who hasn't yet donated to WBAI, to ask you to donate. That's where it starts. 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. If you don't want to become a BAI buddy, call up and make a donation or just set your browser to give to WBAI.org. Okay. Now, getting on to the program itself and the actual agenda for this morning, since we have been deprived of the kind of stuff that I normally do for 7 weeks now, 7 weeks. Let's do that thing. If you do not know who N.K. Jemisin is, even if you are not a reader or fan of science fiction, then you are missing something. Well, excuse me. Yeah, it does help if you're a reader. Not of science fiction, just a reader. But Nora Jemisin, who I have known for I don't know how many years, she's been on this show, well, many times. Partly often as a member of her writer's group, Altered Fluid. But I think the first time she was on this program, she had like published one short story. And at this point, she has won the Hugo Award for Best Novel 3 years in a row. Okay, for brilliant short stories, novels, and it's novels, actually, that she's been winning for. But she's gotten Hugo Awards for short stories 2 years ago for one called The City Born Great. She got the Nebula Award. The Hugo Award is a fan award given out by people who become members of each year's World Science Fiction Convention. The Nebula Award is a peer award that is given out by members of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. And the World Fantasy Award, she won for her novel The Obelisk Gate, as well as The Fifth Season and The Killing Moon. My God. Okay, look. Nora has won for everything, and she damn well deserves it. 100,000 Kingdoms, which was her first major novel, part of the Inheritance trilogy. I'm sorry. I'm looking at nominations, not at winners. That was nominations. But you know what? She's won all these many awards as well. There will be upcoming television series based on her work. For a while, she was writing for the New York Times. She is somebody who's changed the conversation in not just science fiction, but in literature. And I produce downstairs at 388 Atlantic Avenue, not affiliated with WBAI, but affiliated with me. I produce the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. The next one, by the way, December 3rd, is going to be spiffy. It is going to be all science fiction and fantasy and speculative fiction stories about the Beatles. We try to make December a lot of fun, so we want you here for that. Admission is free. Donations to the reading series are accepted. And if you wish to make a donation there to WBAI or a pledge, I'm talking with management as to how we can have somebody collect for the station right there. But these are distinct things. So it was... I don't have it queued up. Let me get there. It was, I think, just about 3 years ago. Let's see. Yes, September 27th. Can that be right? No, that cannot be right. Because we're usually the first Tuesday of each month. What date? Is this show? There's another possibility. I recall it's being September. But anyhow, 3 years ago sounds right that Nora last read for us at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. She's done that event about three or four times. And, well, I will introduce her there. So without further ado, set your Wayback Machine for, about 3 years ago to, yes, the ground floor of this building, 388 Atlantic Avenue, and prepare to enjoy what she considered an imperfect, but is nonetheless a wonderful short story. Now, I didn't have a chance to listen to it yet again, and I assume that it is okay, but I am going to play it safe. We are well after 10 p.m. here in New York City, where we are broadcasting between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. We are in an area of broadcasting called Safe Harbor. That means that with proper due notice, frank language in the name of art can be employed. And certainly the writing and reading of Nora Jemison is art. So, just in case, let me warn you that this reading you're going to hear is not necessarily a safe place. If you are offended by frank language, I advise that you tune out now and rejoin us somewhere before 3 a.m. when Lister will be here for the first time in a couple of months. Yay! With Burn Baby Burn Clappers. And there you go. There you have it. So, you've been given your frank language disclaimer. And having said that, please sit back and enjoy uninterrupted. So let me do a station break first. This is WBAI New York. And you will get to hear who? I think it's me. Speculative fiction, short stories, and novels, who lives and writes in Brooklyn, New York. Her work has been nominated for the Hugo 3 times, the Nebula 4 times, and the World Fantasy Award 2 times. Shortlisted for the Crawford, the Gemmel. The Gemmel Morning Star. I'm going to interrupt me also by saying that, A, again, remember this is 3 years ago. She's won a lot of awards since then. And B, if you are watching on Facebook, FTE, is that not what I said, Max? Oh, full-time equivalent. Yes. Okay, so it's not full-time employees. It's full-time equivalent, says a SAG-AFTRA member. So therefore, 2 part-time people equals 1. Thank you, Max. I wasn't looking like I wasn't looking at my Facebook Live. If you are following the show on Facebook Live, you will want to set your browser at wbai.org. You will not hear the reading well because my camera doesn't pick up the speaker here, or the microphone, as well. Well, it picks up my voice, because I've got that kind of voice. So, I advise you to either tune in 99.5 on your FM dial, if you're in the New York City area, or WBAI.org in order to properly hear the story and, well, my introduction to it. Pardon the interruption. I may interrupt me. I will not interrupt Gemma. Gemma, Jesus. Nora. I'm conflating Jemison and Nora. N.K. Jemison. And the Tiptree. She has won a Locus Award for Best First Novel, as well as the Romantic Times Reviewer's Choice Award 2 times. In 2016, she won the Best Novel Hugo for the 5th season. Thereby becoming almost unbelievably, but very deservedly, the first black writer to win the award in that category. Butler never got it. Delaney never got it in that category. They were Hugo winners, but not for novel. Dahlgren somehow just eluded people. Anything by Butler somehow, well... We won't go on about the Hugos, will we? Finally, let's just say that finally they are catching up to reality. Put there by a bunch of puppies. Well, it's sort of true. That the puppies force people to wake up. Maybe. Let's not go there. The second book in the Broken Earth trilogy, The Obelisk Gate, was just recently released. Not on her bio for some reason, so I added it in. She's also the science fiction book critic for the New York Times. Why I had to add that, I don't know.
I haven't had time to update my blog.
Her short fiction has been published in pro markets such as Clark's World, Postscripts, Strange Horizons, and Bane's Universe, semi-pro markets such as Idiomancer and Avis and Apex, and podcast markets, mostly Escape Artists?
The Escape
Artists
Podcast.
Oh, the Escape Artists Podcast. Okay, I haven't heard them lumped together like that. That's actually useful. And print anthologies. Her first 7 novels, a novella, and a short story collection are currently in print from Orbit Books. She is currently a member of the Altered Fluid Writing Group. There are so many people in Altered Fluid. That was them all hooting just now. In addition to writing, she has been a counseling psychologist and educator, specializing in career counseling and student development, a sometime hiker and biker, and a political, feminist, anti-racist blogger. Everybody, Nora Jemison.
Okay, just a quick thing. I am, like, unusually sensitive, I guess, to the sound of snapping cameras. So after this, we're going to do a brief photo shoot. So if you guys want to take pictures, you can take pictures to your heart's content as soon as we've finished reading. But please try not to... Well, if you have phones that make snappy noises or flashy things... if you could try not to like that. Thank you for the demonstration. During the reading, before or after is fine, but during the reading, please, if you could. Anyway, I am going to be reading a story that I am not entirely happy with, that is not entirely finished. So it's going to be real interesting how this works out. But this is a short story that has already been sold, so I'm going to have to fix it soon. to the POC Destroy Fantasy anthology, which will be getting published, I think, in January? I'm not sure about the publication date. So you will hopefully see a finalized, finished, polished version of this at some point in the future. For now, you're going to get the second draft version. Apologies to the folks from Altered Fluid. You have heard the first draft of this. Okay, Red Dirt Witch by N.K. Jemisin. The way to tell the difference between dreams that were prophecy and dreams that were just wasted sleep was to wait and see if they came 3 times. Emmeline had her 3rd dream about the White Lady on the coldest night ever recorded in Alabama history. This was actually very cold, 10 degrees below zero on a long, dark January Sabbath when even the moon hid behind a veil of shadow. Emmeline survived the cold the way poor people everywhere have done since the dawn of time, with a warm, energetic friend. 3 patchwork quilts helped too. The friend was Frank Heath, who was pretty damn spry for a man of 55, though he claimed to be 45, so maybe that helped. The quilts were M's, and it also helped that one of them had dried flowers, Jack in the Pulpits. There we go. Sorry, size issue. Okay. And it also helped that one of them had dried flowers, Jack in the Pulpits, and a few nuggets of charcoal tucked under each patch of leftover cloth. That made for a standing invitation to warmth in the summertime, who were of course welcome to pay a visit and stay the night any time they liked. Those had come a-calling to the children's beds, at least, for which Emmeline was grateful. The children slept soundly, snug and comfortable. That left Em and Frank free to conduct their own warmth-making with an easy conscience. After that was done, Emmeline closed her eyes and found herself on the commissary market down on Dugan. Dusty southern daylight, bright and fierce even in winter, shone slanting onto the street out alongside the market, unimpeded by cars or carts or people. Pratt City wasn't much of a city, being really just the Negro neighborhood of Birmingham, but it was a whole place, thriving and bustling in its way. Here, though, Emmeline had never seen the place so empty in her life. As if despite the cold, the market's bins tumbled over with summer produce, watermelons and green tomatoes and peaches and more, along with a few early collards. That meant that whatever this dream meant to warn her of, it would come with the heat of the mid-months. Out of habit, M glanced at the sign above these last. Overpriced again, greedy bastards.
Why, greed's a sin, said a soft, whispery voice all around her. Be proper of you to punish him for it, wouldn't it?
This was one of the spirits she'd tamed over the years. They liked to test her, though, so it was always wise to be careful with them. Supposing I could, she said in reply. But only the store manager, since the company too big to go after. And I can't say as I blame the manager either, since he got children to feed same as me.
Sin, sin, woman.
And let she who is without sin cast the first stone, M countered easily, as you well know. Then she checked herself. No sense getting testy. Ill-wishing opened doors for ill winds to blow through, which was probably why the voice was trying to get her to do it. Anyway, sorry. The voice sighed a little in exasperation. It was colorless, genderless, barely a voice at all. That sigh whispered like wind through the stand of pines across the street.
Just telling you somebody coming, cranky old biddy.
Who, Jesus Christ? About time, his slow ass. Whispery laughter.
Fine, then. The white lady are coming, a fine one, and she got something special in mind for you and yours. You ready?
M frowned to herself. The other two dreams had been more airy-fairy than this, just collections of symbols and hints of a threat, omens and portents. It seemed fate had finally gotten impatient enough to just plain say what she wanted to hear, what she needed to hear. No, I ain't ready, M said with a sigh. But ain't like that ever made no mind to some folk. Thank you for the warning. More laughter, rising to become a gale, picking Emmeline up and spinning her about. The market blurred into a whirlwind, but through it all there were little ribbons that she could see edging out into the tornado from elsewhere, whipping about in shining silken red. Truth was always there for the taking if you only reached out to grasp it. Thing was, Em didn't feel like grasping it. She was tired, Lord have mercy. The world didn't change. If she just relaxed, the dream would let her back into sleep like she wanted. But, well, best to be prepared, she supposed. So M stretched out a hand and laid hold of one of the ribbons, and suddenly the street that ran through the market was full of people, angry people, most of them white and lining the road, and marching people, most of them black and in the middle of the road. The black ones' jaws were set, their chins high in a way that always meant trouble when white folks were around, because, Lord, didn't they hate seeing pride.
Trouble, trouble, sang the voice,
and before the marchers appeared a line of policemen with billy clubs in their hands and barking dogs at their sides. Emmeline's guts clenched for the blood that would almost surely be spilled. Pride. Was it worth all that blood? Yet when she opened her mouth to shout at the marchers for their foolishness, the whispery voice laughed again, and she spun again, the laughter chasing her out of dreams and up to reality. Well, this was what she'd wanted, but she didn't much like it because reality was dark and painfully cold on her mouth and chin, which she'd stuck outside the covers to breathe. Her teeth were chattering. She reached back.
Ain't time to get up, muttered Frank at her stirring, half-dreaming himself.
You got Sunday to rest, said Emmeline. You want to live till then, you get to work. His low, rich laugh warmed her more than his body ever could have. Yes, ma'am, he said, and did as he was bid. And because they had set to, Emmeline missed that her only girl child, Pauline, got up and walked the hall for a while, disturbed by bad dreams of her own. Since the spirits had given her a full season's warning, Em spent the time preparing for the white lady's arrival. This meant she finished up as much business as possible in the days right after the dream. The cold passed quickly, as cold was wont to do in Alabama. And as soon as the weather was comfortable again, Emmeline set Pauline to grinding all the herbs she'd laid in since November, and then had her boy Sample put her shingle out by the mail post, where it read, Herbs and Prayers for All and Sundry. This brought an immediate and eager stream of customers. First, there was Mr. Jake, who'd gotten into a spat with his cousin over Christmas dinner and had wished death on him, and now was regretting it because the cousin had come down with a wet cough. Emmeline told him to take the man some chitlins made with sardine oil and extra garlic. Then she handed him a long braid of garlic heads, 10 in all, from her own garden.
That much garlic?
Jake had given her a look of pure affront. Like most men of Pratt City, he was proud of his cooking.
Now look Italian to you?
All right, let him die then. This elicited a giggle from Pauline, who sat in on most of Em's appointments these days. So, grumbling, Jake had brought the garlic from Emmeline and gone off to make his amends. People talked about Jake's stanky, awful chitlins till the day he died. But his cousin ate some of the peace offering, and he got better. And then there was Em's cousin Renee, who came by just to chat and conveniently told Emmeline all the goings-on in and around Pratt City. There was trouble brewing, Renee said. Political trouble. Whispers in the church pews, meetings in the school gym, plans for a boycott or two or ten. Way up in Virginia, folks were suing the government about segregation in the schools. Em figured it wouldn't come to nothing, but all the white folks was up like angry bees over the notion of their precious children sitting next to Negro children, competing next to Negro children, befriending Negro children. It was going to get ugly. Many evils came riding in on the tales of strife, though, so here, Emmeline suspected, would be their battleground. Then there was Nadine Yates, a widow who, like Emmeline, had done what she had to keep herself and her children alive through the cold and not-so-cold days. Nadine was afraid she might be pregnant again. I know it's a sin, she said in her quiet, dignified voice while Emmeline fixed her some tea. For this one, she'd sent Pauline off to the market with her brothers. Pauline was still just a girl, and some things were for grown women's ears only. Still, if you could help me out, I'd be grateful. Sin's making a world where women got to choose between two children eating and three children starving, Emmeline said, and you sure as hell didn't do that. You made sure he wasn't some fool who spread it all over, didn't you? He got a wife and a good job, and he ain't stupid. Gave my boys new coats last week. A man who knew how to keep a woman on the side properly. But then, wouldn't it be simple enough for him to just take care of the new child, too? Emmeline frowned as a suspicion entered her mind. He white? Nadine's nearer jaw flexed a little, and then she lifted her chin in fragile defensiveness. He is. Emmeline sighed, but then nodded toward the tea cooling in Nadine's hand. Drink up now. And it sound like he can afford a guinea hen to me. So a few days later, after the tea had done its work, Nadine dropped by and handed Emmeline a nice fat guinea fowl. It was a rooster, but Em didn't mind. She pot-roasted it with dried celery and a lot of rosemary from her garden, and the rind of an orange that Pauline had found on the road behind a market truck. Emmeline had smacked the girl for that, because even though finding wasn't stealing, white folks didn't care much for making distinctions when it came to little colored girls. But Pauline, who was smart as a whip and Em's pride, had glared at her mother after the blow. Mama, I followed the truck to a stop sign and offered to give it back. I knew the white man wouldn't want it because I touched it, and he didn't, so there. Smart as a whip, but still just a child and innocent yet of the world's worst ugliness. Emmeline could only sigh and thank God the truck driver hadn't been the kind who'd have noticed how pretty Pauline was becoming. As an apology for the smack, she'd let Pauline have half the orange, while the boys each got only a quarter. Then she sat the girl down for a long talk about how the world worked. And so it was. As the brief winter warmed toward briefer spring and began the long, slow march into southern summer, by the time the tomato plants flowered, Em was as ready as she could be. Oh, Miss Emmeline, called a voice from outside. An instant later, Jim and Sample, Emmeline's boys, ran into the kitchen. It's a red lady outside, Sample gushed. Well, go figure, Emmeline said. And like you ain't a quarter red yourself. Her papa had been Black Creek, his hair uncut till death. Not that kind of red, said Sample, rolling his eyes enough to get a hard look from Emmeline. She asking for you. Is she now? Emmeline turned from the pantry and handed Sample a jar of peach preserves. Open that for me and you can have some. Delighted to be treated like a man, Sample promptly sat down and began wrestling with the tight lid. I don't like this one, said Jim. And since Jim was her artist, none of the dreaming in him, but he saw things others didn't. Emmeline knew the time had come. She wiped her hands on a cloth and went out onto the porch to meet the white lady. She smelled the lady before she saw her, a thick waft of magnolia perfume, too cloying to be quite natural. Outside, the perfume wasn't as bad, diminished and blended in among the scents of M's garden and the faint sulfurous miasma that was omnipresent in Pratt City on still days like this. That was from Village Creek, polluted as it was with nearly a century's worth of iron and steel waste. The woman to whom the perfume belonged stood on the grassy patch in front of M's house, fastidiously away from the red dirt path that most people walked to reach her front porch. Why, this lady was just as pretty as a flower, in a full-skirted dress of cotton print, yellow covered in white and green lilies. No crinoline, but nearly as old-fashioned, with layers separated by bunched taffeta and edged in lace. Around the heart-shaped bodice, her skin was white as pearl, so white that M figured she'd have burned up in a minute if not for the enormous parasol positioned over her head. And here was why Sample had called her red. The confection of her hair, spun into an elegant chignon behind her head and topped with a crown of white flowers, was nearly as burgundy as good wine. It was all M could do not to feel inadequate, given that she wore only an old faded house dress, with her own hair done up in plaits and hidden away beneath a wrap. But she drew herself up anyway and reminded herself that she needed no parasol to keep her skin fine. The sun did that itself, and black didn't crack beneath its blessing. Those were just surface things anyway. The white lady was nearly all surface. That was the nature of her kind. That was how this meeting would go then, an appearance of grace and gentility covering the substance of battle.
"Why, I've come to see about you, Miss Emmeline," the white lady said, as if they were in the middle of a conversation and not the beginning. Her voice was light and sweet, as honeyed as her yellow eyes. "You know me."
"Yes, ma'am," M said, because she knew the children were watching, and it wouldn't do for them, especially the boys, to think they could smart off to white ladies, even if this one really wasn't a white lady. "Heard here and there you were coming."
"Did you now?"
She simpered, dimples flashing, and flecked at her skirts. As she did this, M caught a glimpse of a figure behind her. A little black girl, couldn't have been more than seven, crouched and holding the pole of the great big parasol over the woman's head. The little girl's feet were bare beneath the simple white shift she wore, and her eyes were still and empty.
"I suppose I shouldn't be surprised that you heard," the white lady said, unfolding a little lace fan and fluttering it at herself. "Figured you'd have your ways. Could I trouble you for some tea or lemonade, though, Miss Emmeline? It's always almighty hot in this land. Not that that bothers your kind like it does mine."
"Mighty hot indeed," Emmeline agreed evenly. She nodded to Pauline, who stood beside her, trembling a little. Even a half-trained girl child knew power when she saw it. Pauline jumped but went inside. "This land made its natural people brown for a reason, though, ma'am, long before either your nor most of mine came across. Seems to me you could make yourself fit the land better if you wanted, of course." The woman extended one long, thin arm and ran her fingers up the pearly skin, looking almost bemused to find such flesh upon herself.
"I should, I suppose, but you know there's more reward than price comes with this skin."
M did indeed know. "Pauline's gone to fetch some tea for you, ma'am. No lemonade, I'm afraid. Lemons cost too dear when you got three children and no husband, see."
"Ah, yes, about these children of yours."
As much as Emmeline thought she had braced herself, she still couldn't help tensing up when the white lady's yellow eyes shifted to dance over the faces of Jim and Sample. Lord, but she should have guessed. America wasn't the old country. These days the white folk didn't bother with silly tricks or living in mounds, and they didn't stay hidden, for why should they? But the one thing they still did, in spades here in this land of cheap flesh, was steal children. And if they kept the children of a certain hue, why, the police didn't even ask after them. Emmeline set her jaw. The woman's eyes lingered on Jim long enough to be worrying. Jim, smart one that he was, had gone still and quiet, looking down at his feet, knowing better than to meet any woman, white woman's gaze. Sample was all a bristle, not liking the way the woman was eyeballing his little brother. Ah, damnation, Emmeline never should have picked for Sample's father a man who liked to fight. Boy was going to get himself in trouble one day. Em had a feeling, though, that this was a feint. And when Pauline came back onto the porch with a big sweating glass of iced tea, and sure enough, the white lady's gaze landed on the girl with much more than greed for a cool drink. Pauline stopped there with her eyes narrowed, because like Emmeline, she knew what was beneath the surface. The woman laughed prettily at the look on the girl's face. "Trouble come and tell," the white lady sang, still grinning. "Trouble come and find, not to pay the price, but sweet blood like fine wine." She had a beautiful voice, like me. She had a beautiful voice, lilting and hymn reverberant and high as the birds flew. Hardly sounded human, in fact, which was fitting enough. Em raised a hand in praise anyway because beauty was meant to be acknowledged, and to deny it would just invite her further in. "Trouble always comin', ma'am," she replied to the song. "Some of us, this world made a trouble, not that you folk help." "Oh, Miss Emmeline, don't be like that. Come on here, girl, with that tea. It's powerful hot." Em glanced at Pauline. Pauline nodded once, tightly. Then she walked to the step down to the steps to the bottommost slab, no further, and held forth the glass. The white lady sighed, throwing a look at Em. "Ought to raise your children to show some respect, Miss Emmeline." "Lots of ways to show respect, ma'am." The white lady sniffed. Then she turned her head, and the little girl who had been holding the parasol straightened and came around her. The parasol stayed where it was, holding itself up against the ground. As the child moved forward, Em's skin came all over goosebumps. Wasn't right, seeing a child who should have been so lively, should have been lively, so empty of life and magic. The little girl twitched a little while she walked, as if with a palsy, or as if jerked on strings. She stopped before Pauline and held her hands up, and Em didn't blame Pauline at all for her grimace as she pushed the glass into the child's hands. "Whose was she?" Emmeline asked, as the little girl twitched and moved to bring the tea back to her mistress. "Nobody who matters, Miss Em, don't you mind?" The white lady took the glass of tea, then smoothed a hand over the child's soft cap of hair with an almost fond smile. "Such a lovely girl, though, isn't she? Everybody says you folk can't be beautiful, but that's just not true. Where else would I be able to get this?" She preened, smoothing a hand over one unblemished, shining cheek. "She had power," Pauline said. Em started. She was used to Pauline keeping her mouth shut around white folks like a good, sensible girl should. But Pauline was still staring at the little girl in horror. Her expression hardened, though, from shock to disgust. "She had power, and you took it, like a damn thief." The white lady's eyebrows looked to have climbed into her red hair for a moment. Emmeline was right there with her, shocked at Pauline's cheek. She snapped without thinking, "Pauline, Elizabeth, shut your mouth before I shut it." Pauline shut up, though Emmeline could see the resentful flex of muscle along her jaw. But the white lady let out a soft laugh, chilling them both into silence. "Well, I can't say I think much of how you're raising your children, Miss Emmeline. Negro children never can sit still and be quiet, I suppose. Of course I took her power, girl. It's not like she could do anything with it. Now, I think I'm owed an apology, don't you?" "Damnation." Stiffly, Emmeline said, "I'm sorry for my daughter's foolishness, ma'am. I'll see to her when we're done talking." "Oh, but that isn't enough, Miss Em." The white lady tilted her head, long red lashes catching the light. "Honestly, how's she going to learn respect if you do all the apologizing for her?" Pauline spoke tightly with a darting glance at Emmeline for permission to speak. "I'm sorry too, ma'am." "Now see, that wasn't so hard." The white lady gestured with the tinkling glass of tea at Pauline, beaming. "But don't you think you owe me a bit more after smarting off like that? Why, I'm wounded. You called me a thief. And even if I am, it's the principle of the thing." She stepped forward. "I think you should come with me for a while and learn respect, don't you?" "No, ma'am," Emmeline snapped, before Pauline could dig herself further into trouble. "I don't think she owes you a thing beyond what you've had." "Oh, now be reasonable." The white lady stepped forward once more, almost to the porch steps, but then she paused, her smile fading just a little. When she glanced off to the side, she spied the rosemary bush at last, growing scraggly in the summer heat. Growing, though, still, and by its growth weaving a bit of protection around the house. Beginning to frown, the woman glanced to the other side. There was plenty of sage, too, thriving in the heat, unlike the rosemary. Eyes widening, the woman finally turned about, spying at last the prize of Emmeline's yard, the sycamore fig. It grew in an arc over on the far side of the yard because many years ago some neighborhood children had played on it and nearly broken its trunk. It had survived, though, through the heat, through the breaking, and through the isolation, for it was nearly the only one of its kind in America. By the stories Emmeline's own mother had told of its planting, the seed fig had been smuggled over from Africa herself, tucked into some poor soul's womb to keep it safe and living through the Middle Passage. "Supposed to be rowan, thorn, and ash," said the white lady. All at once she sounded sulky. Emmeline lifted her chin. "That'd work too," she said. "'Cause Lord knows I got some Scots-Irish in me from my poor slave mother's slave foremother's travails. But this ain't the soil of ire. Red Alabama dirt roots different protectors. And you ain't the same as back as yourn back in the old country neither, not after all these years of drinking Negro blood, so rosemary, sage, and fig will do for you." The white lady let out a huffy little sound, but then she took a dainty step back. She started to raise the glass of tea, then paused, focusing sharply on it. Her lip curled, then she glared at Pauline. "Just a little bit of acorn flour, ma'am," Pauline said, with such exaggerated innocence in her voice that Emmeline had to stifle a smile in spite of herself. "For flavor." "Rosemary, sage, and fig to bind," said the white lady. It was clear now that she was furious, as she held the glass of tea out from herself and then dropped it. The tea spilled onto the grass, and the glass split into three pieces. She drew in a deep breath, visibly mastering her temper. "And oak to strike the blow. Well, Miss Emmeline, I'll grant you one this one. But it leaves us in a bit of a fix. You can't keep yours safe everywhere, and I can't be chasing after him all damn day and night." She thought a moment. "How about a deal?" "Ain't enough water in the River Jordan," Emmeline snapped. "Sure." The white lady's grin crept back like a dog badly banished. "Safety and prosperity for the rest, if you give me but one." "I done told you no," Emmeline said. She was forgetting to pretend polite. Well, Sample hadn't gotten it only from his father. "How many more times I got to..." "What kind of safety?" asked Pauline. "Lord have mercy, I'm going to have to kill this girl," Emmeline could not help muttering. But Pauline had set her jaw in that tight, stubborn way that meant she didn't care if she got a smack for it. She persisted. "How much prosperity?" Oh, and if that didn't spread the white lady's grin neatly from ear to ear. "Why, lots, sugar. Bless your heart." "Girl, shut your mouth," Emmeline snapped. But the white lady held up a hand, and all at once Emmeline found herself unable to speak. Oh, mercy, Em knew then. Stupid, stupid girl. "Pauline, don't," blurted Jim. But the white lady eyed him too, and he was shut up as firmly as Emmeline herself. Sample just stared from one to the other of his siblings to the white lady, his hands flexing as if he wanted to hit somebody, but wasn't sure where to start. "Children should be seen and not heard," said the white lady, gesturing gracefully with her fan. Oop, typo. Okay. Sorry. "But ladies, with that blood like wine, sweet and high and so fine, get some choices in the matter till it's taken from them. What do you say, Ms. Pauline?" Pauline, to her credit, glanced at Emmeline again. Her belligerence had faded by now, and her small face was properly anxious and afraid. Then, too, her jaw firmed, and she faced the white lady squarely. "You said trouble was coming." "Oh, indeed." The white lady let her gaze drip left and right, syruping all over the boys. "So much trouble. Folks getting uppity from here to the Carolinas. Desegregation. Non-discrimination. And don't you know them bullnecks will be hitting back fast, beating y'all back into your place." She stopped her gaze on hot-headed Sample. Sample set his jaw. "Hitting back hard, I tell you, on boys who think to be called men. Pauline caught her breath. Then, though, thank the Lord, she bit her bottom lip. "I want to speak to my mother." There was a moment's long, pent pause. Then the white lady flipped her fan back up into a blurring wave, dropping back into a mocking curtsy. The servant child moved jerkily back behind her, taking hold of the parasol again. "Seeking counsel is wise and within the rules besides," the white lady admitted. "Not too much counsel, though, little miss. Some deals don't last long." With that, she flounced off with the child in tow, though Emmeline noted that she skirted wide around the sycamore fig before passing through a pine tree and vanishing. The instant Emmeline could speak and move, she did, hurrying over to Pauline and slapping the tar out of the girl before she could speak. Didn't I tell you about folks like that? She demanded, pointing with a shaking hand after the white lady. Didn't I tell you they'll put a pretty orange in your hand and snatch it back with the hand attached? It had been happening more and more lately that Pauline defied her. But then, this was only proper, was it not? A girl coming into her womanhood and her adult power should speak her mind sometimes. I know, Mama, Pauline said, without a trace of apology. Her voice was so calm and strong that even Emmeline blinked. But I had dreams. Well, you should have told me. And you should have told me about the blood coming. I know how to make you safe for at least a bit of time, and you can't make me safe, Mama. Pauline said it so sharp, her gaze so hard, that Emmeline could only flinch back. That's why you told me to be scared. That's why you told me what to be scared of, ain't it? So I could make myself safe. And I know, because you taught me, that it's a woman's job to fight for what's hers. That's a man's job, Jim said, scowling. Though he too should have been quiet, cowed by the slap. Sample nodded fiercely. Emmeline groaned and put a hand in the air for strength. All of her children had forgotten how to mind all at once. Decent folks' job, then, Pauline said back with a little heat. But, Mama, I saw it in the dream. People marching, big old redneck bulls standing up like men, holding dogs and billy clubs, blood everywhere. Emmeline's skin went all a prickle with remembered fear. Yet there was no fear in Pauline's face as she went on, her voice rising in excitement. At the end of it, though, Mama, at the end, I saw white children and black children sitting by each other in school. It was yellow and brown and red children there, too. Black people at the front of a bus. Mama, Pauline bit her lip, then leaned forward to whisper, though there was no one to hear it but family. I saw a black man in a big white house. There were always black men in the big white houses of downtown Birmingham. Who else was going to tend their gardens or wash their cars? And yet, there was a fervor in Pauline's gaze that warned Emmeline there was something more to her daughter's dreams. Didn't matter, though. The world didn't change, and somebody had to protect her fool children from themselves. Seething with pent-up anger and fear, Emmeline herded the children inside. She made them go to bed early with no supper for smarting off, because they had to learn, Pauline especially. Wasn't no prosperity worth a girl child's soul and what little innocence life allowed her? Wasn't no safety for black boys beyond what humility bought them, little as that was. And while they slept, Emmeline burned sage, and she prayed to every ancestor of three continents who might listen, and then she set herself up in a chair before the door with her grandmother's old musket across her knees. She would stay up day and night, if she had to, for her children's sake. After a few hours had passed in slow and taut silence, and the candles burned low, and the weight of drowsiness pressed on the back of her head like a blanket, Emmeline got up to keep herself awake. She peeked in the boys' room. They were snoring, curled up, though Jim had a half-eaten peach still in his hand, sneaked out from some hiding place or another against just such an occasion of their mother's wrath. Pauline's room, though, was cold from the open window, wafting sharp, bitter wind over the girl's empty bed. Just realized that's a typo, too. Fix that. Okay. I'm going to pause here. We've got about 15 minutes worth more of reading. Raise your hand if you are okay with continuing. If you would like to pause, oh. Okay. Tired. Sorry. Let me shut up. There was only one place the girl could have gone, the fairgrounds in the shadow of Red Mountain. Emmeline ran to Renee's house, since Renee had the only working phone on the street. There she called Frank, who came over bringing his mule. The mule ran like it knew what was at stake, so fast and hard that Emmeline's bottom was raw long before she reached the place. The fairgrounds were only fairgrounds once a year. The rest of the time it was just a fallow field, occasionally used for harness racing. Long ago, though, it had been the breaking ground of a plantation, the place where new slaves, freshly force-marched up from the port of Mobile, got branded and stripped of name and spirit before being sent into the fields. As Emmeline halted the mule and slid off its back, she felt all that old blood there in the ground mixed in with old tears and the red dirt beneath her feet. White folk fed on that sort of magic. This would be a place of power for them. As Em reached the top of the hill, she saw that Pauline stood beneath a pine that was being strangled by a carpet of kudzu. Before her stood the White Lady, shining even more now, her skin catching the moon's gleam in the way of her people, ears gone to points and mouth too wide and sharp and full of sharp fangs. They both turned as Emmeline thumped up, out of breath, her legs shaking from holding so tight to the mule's sides. Still, she moved to stand between them in front of Pauline and facing the White Lady. "I ain't gonna let you."
"Deal's done, Miss Emmeline," said the White Lady, looking amused. "Too late."
Emmeline turned to Pauline, shaking, horrified. Pauline, though, lifted her chin.
"I saw it, Mama," she said. "One life for three. Trouble coming whether we want it or not, but if I go, you and the boys will get through it."
In a wordless fury, Emmeline flung herself at the White Lady. She did this without using her body, and the White Lady met her without hers, taking her up and out and through and into dreaming. Thing was, dreaming wasn't a thing mortal folks did so well when they were awake, so Emmeline tumbled, helpless, lashing out ineffectually. And in the perverse way of her kind, who loved to lie but liked it best of all when truth became their weapon, the White Lady showed Emmeline the future that Pauline had bought. She saw markets full of melons and greens and peaches, all artificially fresh and reeking of chemicals in the dead of winter. Long elevated strips of road carving up Negro towns and neighborhoods all over the country. Gray looming schools isolating bright black minds and breaking their spirits and funneling them into jails. Police everywhere, killing and killing and killing. This, Emmeline fought nausea and despair, lest she strengthen her enemy. But it was nearly impossible not to feel something. Oh, Lord, her baby had given up her freedom for this. And yet, all at once, Emmeline was not alone in her tumbling. Pauline, new and raw and woman strong, pushed at Emmeline, helping her straighten up. Then Pauline pointed, snatching more truth from the White Lady's dream than even she wanted shown. The White Lady hissed into their minds like ice on a griddle. Pauline ignored this and said, "Look, Mama." And then Emmeline saw the rest. Marching black people attacked by dogs, but still marching. Children, sample, struck by the blasts of fire hoses, the torrent peeling off clothes and tearing skin, still marching. Joined by dozens, hundreds, thousands, hundreds of thousands, still marching. Before these marches, prayers and church plate dinners, Emmeline sprinkling a little fire into the chicken and dumplings to warm the marchers against the cold hose water to come. Young women refusing to be ordered out of their bus seats to go sit in the back, Emmeline braiding a donkey's stubbornness into their hair. Children holding their heads high through crowds of shouting, jeering white teenagers and adults. Emmeline trimming a few figs from the sycamore to make jam, sweetening the children's mouths with the taste of heritage and survival. And so much more. Brown faces in space. Emmeline could only stare at the stars and savor the impossible possibility. Brown men on the Supreme Court. Then she saw the White House that Pauline had mentioned. The White House, nestled amid statues and obelisks and the mirror pool of Washington, D.C., a place of power in itself. She saw a man standing on its steps, brown as fig jam, and then a woman, black as molasses, her gaze hard and high and proud, and then another woman, and another brown man, and so many more, their frequency increasing with the spinning of the sun. Still marching, never stopping till freedom was won. Pauline's single sacrifice could set all of it in motion, but...
"No!"
Emmeline fought her way back toward wakefulness.
I can't. It can't be me who stays.
She didn't believe. She had taught her children to bow their heads, not lift them up high.
I'm not what they need.
You gonna be all they get, sugar, said the White Lady into the dream with a laughing whisper.
No. No, she damn well would not be. The dream still spun around her. Emmeline set her jaw and plunged her hand into it, grabbing wildly this time and pulling back the jar of sycamore jam. Sin, sin, she snapped. The top of the jar was tight, but she wrestled it off and plucked out a dripping, soft sycamore fig to brandish against the churning dark. A deal's a deal, but one kind of prey is the same as another to you, lot, ain't it? You like children's beauty, but a woman's don't hurt you none. You like innocence, but you'll take foolishness. So here's mine. I can't believe the world will ever change. I can't hope. It ain't in me. Spent too long making it easier for people to live downtrodden. I know how to survive, but I ain't got the fight for change in me. Not like my baby does. So take me and leave her. No, Pauline shouted, but Emmeline had enough control to drown her out with the sound of chanting, marching crowds. The shape of the white lady had blurred in the dream, but she was still a sharp-toothed presence amid the swirl. Take you both, child and fool, all mine. Emmeline grinned. Greed's a sin. The dream cracked a little beneath good Christian truth, allowing Em to summon the whiff of burned sage. The white lady flinched, hard enough to slow the whirlwind of the dream, for the smell carried with it lamentations for stolen lands, stolen children, and the stolen lives of Em's Creek forebears. Emmeline set that in place opposite the jar of figs. Your bargain was one for three, not two for two. Images of marchers warped and twisted all around them, the White House dissolving into the foxy face of the white lady. True enough, she said, conjuring up her fan again. Still, I'd rather...
Oh my gosh, you all right?
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah,
right. All right, see, this is what happens when you invite bad magic in. Anybody got some sage or some salt to sprinkle? Nobody's hurt, right?
No.
Okay, good. For folks listening at home, we almost had a very bad accident. Okay, so where was I? Something about... Oh, yes, yes, okay. Still, I'd rather the child if you didn't mind, or even if you do. Here, Emmeline faltered. She had not dreamt of Rosemary. Frantically, she rifled through images, tossing away the fish she'd dreamt of before each of her children, shoving aside the green tomatoes and collards of the market. Lord, had she never once dreamt of baking chicken? She had not. But then, through the tittering laughter of the white lady and her cronies, Emmeline smelled a dream of pot-roasted guinea rooster with orange peel and rosemary. That had been the first time Emmeline accorded her daughter the respect of a fellow woman. Oh, and Pauline had been savoring that feeling all this time. There was a bit of innocence attached to it, too, lost after Emmeline's explanation about white men's oranges. The perfect sweetening to lure in hungry Fay. And indeed, the white lady paused, lifting her face a little and half-closing her eyes in pleasure at the toothsome aroma. But then she stiffened as she caught the rosemary's perfume. Rosemary, sage, and fig, said Pauline in a tone of satisfaction. Now let my mama take me, Emmeline said, commanded now, because she could. She had bound the white lady by both the ancient rules of the old country and the newer rules of flesh and blood. The deal had been made, one innocent life for three lives protected and prosperous, but Emmeline had control over which life the white men got to keep, and at least. Mama! Pauline, her beautiful, powerful Pauline, abruptly resolved out of the dream's swirl and turned to her. Mama, you can't! Hush. Emmeline went to her, held her close, kissed her corn-rowed head. I done told you a million times that the world doesn't change, but I was wrong. And I'm sorry for that. You got a big fight ahead of you, but you can win it. And you're better suited to that fight than I'll ever be. She hugged the girl tight. Be strong, baby. Tell your brothers the same. I know y'all are anyway. Pauline clutched at her. But Mama, you can't. I didn't want... The white lady closed the dream around Emmeline and whisked her away. In the morning, Pauline woke up on the ground of the fairgrounds, wet with dew and weeping. Her brothers, who had come up to the fairgrounds to find her, came quietly to her side to hold her tight. Sorry, just about another typo. Okay. Cousin Renee took the children in, of course, for blood was blood. She sent them one by one to Alabama State for their learning, so they were there when the Freedom Rides began. Naturally, all three joined up. Through the dark times that followed, the foretold dogs and hoses and beatings, and the unforeseen lynchings and assassinations and bombings, there were white folk aplenty doing evil, but no white folk. The Fae did not go again where they had been bested once, and in any case, their time was waning. The dirt of Alabama was red for many reasons, not the least of which is that it was full of iron ore. It took a lot of power to overcome that much iron. And the times were changing such that not even black children could be stolen with impunity anymore. The white folk kept their promise, at least. Jim got his arm bitten by a dog during a protest, but it did not tear his throat out. Hard-headed Sample dated a white woman and only had to flee town. The men who meant to chain him up behind their truck and drag him to death did not catch him. Pauline got married, dreamt of fish, and made her own daughters to carry on the family legacy. After a few more years, she ran for city council and won, and nobody strung her up. Then she ran for mayor and won that, too. All the while, she turned a tidy profit from her sideline barbecue business. The Greens had a little extra warmth in them that made everyone feel a bit better towards each other, so she called them Freedom Greens, mostly as a joke. But one year, the black man Pauline had dreamt of in the White House passed through town, and he decided to come all the way to Pratt City to have some of Pauline's famous Freedom Greens. Folk went wild. Somebody paid her to write a book about her life. Someone optioned the film rights. Companies called and asked to franchise her recipe, but Pauline said no, instead hiring a small staff of Pratt City dwellers and leasing a commercial kitchen to fill all the thousands of orders of greens for herself. In every can, mind, there was a sprinkle of rosemary, sage, and a tiny dab of sycamore fig, just to cut the bitterness. And late one winter's night, Pauline dreamt again of the white folk. She saw how lean and poorly they were looking these days, deprived of their easy prey, and as the hate of the world dwindled and left them hungry. But she fought the urge to smile at their misfortune, for ill wishing would only make them stronger. She caught a glimpse of a painfully familiar black face among their foxy whiteness, strong and proud and shining in its own way. A face that was smiling and satisfied and full of motherly pride. So the world changed. And so Pauline woke up and went to hug her oldest daughter close, whispering to her of secrets and savory things and dreams yet to come, and of great Grammy M, never to be forgotten, who would one day also be free. Yeah.
Nora Jemison, everybody, N.K. Jemison, from about 3 years ago at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And a good time was had by all. This is WBAI, listener-sponsored non-commercial radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, webcasting at WBAI.org, and video casting over Facebook Live for about another 15 minutes. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. And let's see, what do I have on the agenda? Nothing very specific. If you would like to call up and discuss stuff, the telephone number here is 212-209-2877. But most importantly, we need your donations. And we are asking people to become WBAI buddies is the best way to do it. Right now, we have to demonstrate, after all the travails we have been through, that we not only have financial support from you, the listeners, but that we have membership support. And the best way to do that is by getting monthly donations. And you can become a monthly donor, a.k.a. a BAI buddy, at rates. Actually, can be as low as $5 a month. But I'm asking people to sign up for $25 a month. But make it the number you can afford. And the way you can do that is by calling our pledge line at 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, and say, I would like to become a WBAI buddy, except say it like a normal human being instead of the way I just did. And you can also go to WBAI.org and follow the prompts that say donate here. And when it asks you what's your favorite show, we all know it's Hour of the Wolf, right? But you know what? Right now, it's not that important to, well, yeah, it's important to show support for the show, but
it's important to be a good buddy.
It's important to be a good buddy. It's important to support the radio station that is the platform for this show. And if they, capital T, want to know, and they do, who caused that donation, they can see at what time it came in, and they'll link it to this radio show anyway. So I'm not that worried about somebody clicking the drop-down box and saying, this is for Hour of the Wolf. No, it's for WBAI, okay? So give, and by the way, if you just want to make a straight donation, nobody's going to turn that down. But right now, we are really, really focusing on the idea of the BAI buddy. So again, 516-620-3602 or go to WBAI.org and follow the prompts. You can also get there a little quicker by going to give to WBAI.org. Now, I know, you know, here's another wonderful bit of misinformation, Lister. If you know how everybody says go to give to, and it's number two, WBAI.org. If you type in give to, T-O, WBAI,
it works.
It takes you to the same freaking place. So why do everybody insist?
Except if you do it in Roman numeral, you won't go anywhere, right?
That's right.
Okay.
It'll be give WBAI.org. And if you want to talk about WBAI, thinking II is a, you know, understandable kind of a reaction. So, yeah, I actually more like I. Sigh. Okay, so let's see. What? Oh, yes, once again, the next New York Review of Science Fiction reading will occur the first Tuesday of the month. That will be December 3rd. And the theme is Across the Universe. Now, you, Lister, as a music producer, can you name why, can you guess why we're calling it Across the Universe? It's a musical clue.
Is it because of Yip Hopper, Across the Rainbow?
Who wrote a song? Who did a song? Famous song. Even had a movie about them called Across the Universe.
Across the Universe. Ooh,
the Beatles.
Yeah.
It's the Beatles.
So
the Beatles in science fiction and fantasy. We had Jim Ryan on the show some time back. He's actually not in this book called Across the Universe, but he had a wonderful short story that he read on the air that was an alternate universe story. There's, of course, a movie out there right now called Yesterday, which is a speculative fiction story involving the Beatles, in which the memory of the Beatles is erased from mankind, except for one, or I think two people.
That's a great movie.
That, have you seen it?
No, no, but the whole concept fascinates me.
Oh, there's a better concept than that. But I, there was a play called Liverpool Fantasy.
Yeah.
And I've talked about this on the air a whole lot, so I'm not going to get into the whole thing now. But Larry Kerwin, best known as a lead performer in the band Black 47,
I know Larry personally. He's a good buddy of mine. Seriously.
Really?
Yeah, no,
well, he wrote that play.
Yeah.
He wrote that play.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding at all. And he also wrote it as a book. And that play, let me tell you something, that play could have and should have gone to Broadway.
Right.
And when I went to see it off Broadway in an empty public school,
There
were limos. There were limos parked around the block of wealthy people, producers, that had come to see the show.
Yeah.
And nobody would go near it.
Why? Copyrights?
Not copyright. The author's right there. Larry Kerwin's right there to sell it to you. He'll give you the right to copy it. He'll give you the right to buy it.
What was...
Let's think. Okay, so here's a story taking place in what was then the modern age, late 80s, early 90s, taking place in the hall, in the home of John and Cynthia Lennon. John is represented as a wife beater, which is a fact. Sorry, people. There are police records.
I know, but the marketeers don't want to hear that.
Marketeers? Forget the marketeers. Forget the mar. It's not about the marketeers. It's about one person who's alleged to have broken up the Beatles.
Oh, no.
That's the one. Now, how long before you produce a play showing John Lennon in an unfavorable light? He's also shown in a favorable light. Paul McCartney becomes a lounge singer. Richard Starr becomes a, you know, he just plays in any pub he can. George Harrison becomes a priest. All this alternate universe stuff based on the idea that Please Please Me was the B-side of their first single. And it was supposed to be the B-side of their first single. Till There Was You was the A-side. But the producer, George Martin, no relation to the writer, the producer flipped it around, put the Beatles' original song, Please Please Me, as the A-side. And that's what made the Beatles a world hit. So the premise of the play and the ensuing novel is that it flipped around. Now it's 30 years later, and the world is very different. The movie Yesterday is but a bare comparison. A bare shadow in comparison. Now, you can't easily make a movie of what I'm talking about. But let's face it, if you were to try to produce that on Broadway, how long before you get sued out? And you'd never open. There would be so many lawsuits laid on you. Apple Records. Any number of the wives of Paul McCartney. Any number of the wives. Is Cynthia Lennon still alive? And his son is portrayed as a skinhead. The point is, it could never be done for commercial reasons. But if you know Larry Kerwin personally, I want you to tell him. I'm out of time. I want you to tell him that I would love to produce that play as a radio drama.
Oh, that's a great idea.
I know it's a great idea. I've had it since I saw the play for 20 years. But I don't know Mr. Kerwin. I like his music. I like his writing, but
he emails me all the way.
Fine. Please let him know that you know somebody at BAI who would like to, you know, I promise you that while we don't have the situation here, I promise you I can get the funding to produce either an audiobook or a radio drama of that play. I know he wrote it as a novel, but you can't even, that's out of print. Okay, so having said all that, thank you all for listening. My apologies. I did have a guest lined up for this morning, Robert Levy, who has a new book out. But I thought it was best not to, under these circumstances, not knowing what this morning's show would bring. So he'll be on in 2 weeks. Next week, I have to confirm the guest. We will find out. And in December, lots of good stuff. In the meantime, please, everybody, stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lester. Yay! Coming your way in just 2.5 minutes. And everybody, be good to each other. Stay tuned. Become a WBAI buddy. And have a wonderful, wonderful week. Good morning.
When I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
a
revolutionary.
The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works. Jerk, my people, the people all around the peace work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too.
Yeah, yeah.
You gave me freedom of speech in the first
99 Sinker listens alive. Back where he belongs. Jim Frine, great show this morning. Welcome back, Jim Frine. Welcome back. Terry Wilson, Aptis Selassie. Welcome back. Max Moon. Max under the shadow knows. Alright. Felipe Luciano and Son, welcome back. Burn, baby, burn. 99 Cinco, WBAI. Fundraising time, make it 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. 6 minutes after 3 o'clock, that means we're gonna start off with the buddy system. The buddy system. We gotta get like 25 buddies to sign up right now at 516-620-3602. 99 single. Let's do this. Vinette Price has a great article in her latest column in the Caribbean. Caribbean Life magazine on the status of this station.
Revenge is the sweetest thing. Watch the way you're talking, don't push me. I got no reason to be reasonable. Flipping 50 J's in a month. Give me the beat, throw some weed in a blunt. It's a game of honor now. This can start a moment. Spark a revolution. Don't see no change in me. Just wait to see my revolution. My revolution,
my revolution, yeah.
Music, the men, feel no pain. Judah, lion, break every chain. Rasta music in the city, got the people jumping. Let's stand together so they know the revolution coming. The ghetto people still crying in the streets now. There is no justice for police knocking the people down. There is no peace, they lose their faith. Burning and looting and no money relay. I got no reason to be reasonable. Flipping 50 J's in a month. Give me the beat, throw some weed in a blunt. It's a game of honor now. This can start a movement. Spark a revolution. Don't see no change in me. Just wait to see my revolution.
Chance his girlfriend came across a needle and soon she did the same. At home there were 70-year-old boys and their idea of fun is being in a gang called the Disciples, high on crack, toting a machine gun. Time. church and kill everyone inside. You turn on the telly and every other story is telling you somebody died. My sister killed a baby cause she couldn't afford to feed it, and it was sending people to the moon. In September my cousin tried reefer for the very first time. Now he's good horse, it's June. Falls and a bomb falls. Will anybody see the dawn? Time.